from Michigan Public. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Christian Brotherhood based in Michigan again comes under fire as one of its members faces accusations of child sexual abuse.
After the story came out, another girl reported Treadwell had sexually assaulted her at a Christian school in Grand Rapids.
Also, Pontiac residents rally around their immigrant neighbors as ICE presence increases in the area.
You see the empty buildings and you see the playgrounds that are empty, which used to be full of children laughing and playing. They're just not there anymore.
And a group of writers revives a WPA travel guide format to put a little shine on mid-Michigan's communities.
For the people that lived here and to interest visitors in taking a look, taking a trip.
All that coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to dive in on a WPA-style travel guide that was designed to inspire people to explore mid-Michigan.
You need history, yes, but you need literature, too.
That's coming up later this hour. But first, an all-male Christian brotherhood based in Michigan called the Servants of the Word has come under scrutiny over the last few years. Its members pledged to live a celibate life of missionary service and embed themselves in communities all over the state and the globe. Back in 2020, Michigan Public Newsroom editor Lindsay Smith reported a story about one of the brothers in Servants of the Word. His name is Jamie Treadwell, and he avoided prosecution, even though families had reported him to police many times. Lindsay joins us now to tell us about a different brother who was in the group facing sexual assault charges decades after the first were reported. Lindsay, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
Let's play a little catch up on the brother that first came to your attention, Jamie Treadwell. You told us that at least two families reported criminal experiences with their children back in 2020. Can you remind us, did he face any consequences after that story came out?
Yeah. So after the story came out, another girl reported Treadwell had sexually assaulted her at a Christian school in Grand Rapids that he'd been doing an art residency at. He was a really well-celebrated artist. He was an art prize. He worked regularly with kids and even co-founded a youth group over his decades with the Brotherhood. Now, with this new report, Kent County prosecutor charged Treadwell with two felony counts of criminal sexual conduct against children under the age of 13. He ended up going through preliminary hearings, but took a plea deal on reduced charges. He pled no contest. He was sentenced to time served, which was 2 weeks, and then released on probation. He will always be on the sex offender registry, but he did also leave the Brotherhood very shortly before that story came out.
So let's pivot now to why we asked you to come talk to us today. There were new criminal charges filed in Northern Ireland against a different man who's also in the same brotherhood. Who is Ed Conlon?
Well, Jamie Treadwell and Ed Conlon were really close at one point. They co-founded and ran a group for at-risk kids in Belfast in Northern Ireland together in the 1990s. That's where these new charges are coming from, too. Very young women who met Conlon through this program for at-risk youth said they were groomed and then assaulted by Conlon. But to tell you a little bit more about who Ed Conlon is, I want to introduce you to Noelle Lynn. She was doing mission work in Detroit about a decade ago, got to know Brotherhood members through this work. She was involved in some covenant communities. And the very first time I met her, years ago when she was still living in Grand Rapids, before Treadwell was convicted, we talked for like 2 hours about he had escaped prosecution for so long. And because she was so knowledgeable about the covenant communities the Brotherhood volunteers their time with, at the end I kind of asked her if she thought then Treadwell was an indication of a larger issue in the Brotherhood, like, are others out there grooming kids like this? And this was her answer.
Heck yes, there's something more going on. Call me a conspiracy theorist, call me crazy. They're just making it sound like he just made a couple mistakes when really he was calculated. His actions were consistent. So I do think there's a bigger problem. I do think there are more people being protected. And it really breaks my heart to say that.
So Noelle's gut in 2019 was spot on, it turns out, right? The Brotherhood now acknowledges that three of its members have faced allegations of abuse, and one of them is Ed Conlin. He now faces 7 counts of indecent assault is the charge in Northern Ireland.
So did the leadership of this Brotherhood, the Servants of the Word, know about these allegations regarding Conlin before the police started getting involved?
Yes. The 2 members of the youth group reported to leadership that Ed Conlin abused them decades ago. They did that then. He lost his job at the youth group, and the Brotherhood brought Conlin back to the United States, back home to home base, which is in a rural area west of Ann Arbor. But in 2005, they allowed Conlin to move to Detroit. He worked as a substance abuse counselor. He was certified, and he worked with people who were homeless, and he volunteered at a very well-known soup kitchen in Detroit. So he was definitely around in the community, and Servants of the Word acknowledge that it failed to communicate to the people in Detroit that they placed him with, that they had sexual allegations against him. It failed to oversee his work there. They have acknowledged that. Detroit is where Noelle Lynn got to know Conlin really well. So I called her last month after he got arrested.
So Ed was seen as what people would call like a rock star saint. People would casually refer to him as Saint Ed. Like they saw him as someone who is holy and was virtuous and kind and generous.
Ed is a musician. He wrote tons of worship music for covenant communities. So a lot of that music still gets used. Noelle was doing service work in Detroit when she says Conlin really took an interest in her and a few of the younger women that she worked with there. She says they were not like underage. They were very young adults and the relationships weren't sexual. But in hindsight, she does think it's kind of scary.
Now looking back, it's so inappropriate, but he was known for these special relationships with women and girls. And we know now that he wasn't supposed to be interacting with us that way. He actually wasn't supposed to be having anything to do with our youth work, but he was involved in it all.
When the news started coming out about Jamie Treadwell, people like Noelle Lynn and others inside those communities or who were familiar with the communities or left, they apparently immediately started talking about Ed Conlin, too.
Oh, okay. Where is this man now? Is Ed Conlin still living with the Brotherhood in Michigan?
No, he left the Brotherhood a couple of years ago, 2023, after a woman who grew up in a covenant community here in Ann Arbor alleged that he raped her when she was a teen. Since then, since he left the Brotherhood, he's been living in South Bend, Indiana, with his siblings, his adult siblings. The U.S. Marshals arrested him in May. He petitioned a federal judge to get released because he helps take care of his disabled brother. And he's 69 years old. He has quite a few health issues that he outlined for the judge. He hasn't been working in youth groups. He's been working food service at a hotel chain, but this federal judge decided he would not give him a shot at bail. So he has been in custody until he was just extradited from the U.S. at the end of July. And a trial date hasn't been set yet. So
he's in custody in the United Kingdom.
That's correct, yeah.
Lindsay, this Brotherhood, Servants of the Word, exists outside of a lot of our faith institutions. It's not part of the Catholic Church. It's not part of any Protestant denomination. Mm-hmm. And you've told me in the past, a lot of its appeal among these relatively young, leaning Christian covenant communities is sort of that unaffiliated quality. It makes its own rules. It's ecumenical, very welcoming to people who may have different Christian backgrounds. But we're learning more and more about how this background of it and that lack of ties with any church has made it kind of a safe space for abusers. Is there anyone who can hold the Brotherhood accountable?
I mean, it is tricky because because of that setup, the police and prosecutors, when this abuse gets reported, have been able to put cases together, criminal cases together. But they have been very, very long delayed. And there's definitely been accusations that I think are still yet to surface. There have been civil lawsuits as well against the Brotherhood, and some of those settlements are, I suppose, in some way accountability. They have asked for forgiveness from members and the communities that they work with regularly. But I think this has definitely caused schism within certain communities that were closely tied to these groups. And a lot of that accountability is just going to be in membership numbers and whether or not people stay and want to stay affiliated with them.
Is the Brotherhood's, the Servants of the Word, still active?
Yes, they are definitely still active. They still have their home base. They have houses all over Michigan and the world, frankly. So in the communities where they do mission work, that's the service that they're sort of providing.
Ed Conlin's attorney emailed a statement to Michigan Public, quoting here, "Ed Conlin maintains his innocence to these charges. Court records show that Conlin pleaded not guilty to the charges this month. His attorney says he expects, quoting, to clear his name by being exonerated of these accusations." Lindsay Smith from Michigan Public's newsroom. You can read her ongoing coverage of Servants of the Word at michiganpublic.org. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I hate to bring this up, but we are reaching the tail end of summer. We do have an episode of On Hand coming your way soon to match the vibe. It's all about Superman ice cream, and we need your help to finish the story. We're looking for your ice cream memories. Do you have a favorite family tradition involving an underrated local spot or a certain favorite flavor? Or maybe you've tried to recreate the Superman ice cream blend at home. If you have a memory in mind, please do send it our way. You can reach us on email. The address is onhand@michiganpublic.org. Here it is one more time, onhand@michiganpublic.org. It's time for a break. When we return, what neighbors witnessed as community members continue to live with the threat of aggressive immigration enforcement from ICE. And what they're doing to support each other.
I don't know if people understand that when you're losing someone who you're very close to, you then have to say, well, I'm not allowing this to happen again to someone else. I have to do something.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You may not be hearing quite as much in the headlines these days about immigration enforcement, but immigrant communities all over Michigan are still living under the threat of aggressive detention and deportation techniques. Pontiac is one of several Michigan cities where neighbors are organizing to help other neighbors. Elida Reyes is the founder of Community Aid for Empowerment and a longtime Pontiac resident. Elida, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We've invited her along with one of her partners in this work, Alexis Hike, who's an organizer with CAFE and also a school teacher. Alexis, good to have you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Elida, can you talk to us a little bit about what the community in Pontiac looks like? Who lives here and what are the demographics?
Well, now, I couldn't tell you. I could tell you before the ICE was here. We were vibrant. We had lots of stores opening up. We had restaurants. We had a lot of workers. I mean, it was a very, we had a lot of music in neighborhoods, dancing. It was, it, the churches, oh my goodness, the churches were packed. Beautiful sermons, weddings, baptismals. Everyone was invited to them. And unfortunately now, after ICE, you can see a huge difference. Apartment buildings are half empty. The churches aren't as vibrant. People are staying indoors, behind doors. They're afraid. They call on you to ask them to go grocery shopping, or they're relying on food banks because they're afraid to leave their home for any amount of time. People that do leave their homes, if they have their children with them, it doesn't matter. ICE will take them in front of their children. They're ruthless. They've told children to shut up, quit crying, and our children are not attending school. Attendance is way down. Children who have been terrorized and seen ICE have gone back to bedwetting and being afraid to be left alone. It's just horrible. You can't miss it when you're here. You see the empty buildings and you see the playgrounds that are empty, which used to be full of children laughing and playing. They're just not there anymore.
Elita, when did you first start to notice that things were changing, that families were disappearing and dropping out of sight?
I noticed it in my church. I go to All Saints, and we had a fair amount of people from Venezuela who I know why they were here, because many of them did not endorse Maduro at the beginning, and they were afraid of the retribution that he was promising and did do to many people. But we had also other people, you know, from Latin America coming here. Wonderful. I mean, our church was growing. Mass was being split both in English and in Spanish. It was wonderful. And then one day I noticed that they were gone. And I was like, what's happening? Where are they going? And that's when I asked my church, we need to do something. We need to start, you know, a group. Something has to be done. We need to look into the laws. And are they following the laws when they're taking people? Because they were not.
Alexis Hike, you're a teacher. Can you maybe share what you've seen about how the community has been affected by this, and maybe especially students?
Yeah, I think in the bigger picture, our events, like our after-school events, any sort of conferences, they were always very full, like line out the door, everything like that. And it was primarily Hispanic families that were coming. And now with this increase in ICE activity, they're all empty. The enrollment was down significantly this past year. I know that I'm at the preschool, and our enrollment was like less than half of what it used to be at the start of the school year. And they said in the school board meetings that ICE was a big factor in that many families are afraid to send their kids. Like, they might be safe while they're at school, but what about the route there? Or while the children are at school, they're afraid that the parents will be picked up. So there's a fear from all sides, really, from the parents, the children. The children are terrified, and they don't get to be kids anymore. Like Elida was saying, they, you know, there's no more walking to the playground to go have fun. So we're putting so much, there's so much extra fear and trauma for all of these kids. They don't get to be kids anymore. There's so much, they have to grow up so much faster than we would expect of any other group, just because there is a very real, very credible threat to themselves and their families.
So I think I'm hearing you say this has really, the drop-off's been notable in this past 25-26 school year, even that recently?
Oh, it's absolutely. It's been significant. And we, part of our school was wondering if it was because the school had shifted from one building to a different building, but it actually was across the district. That information that was presented at the school board meeting was across the district, pre-K to 12th grade.
Elida, can you maybe talk about what motivated you to create CAFE, Community Aid for Empowerment, and what you're hoping to offer folks who are living with these fears right now?
The stories are out there. You can hear various different types of stories. And a young woman showed up to All Saints by the name of Vera, and they asked me as a Latina if I could help her out. And I did. I brought her into my home. And I know she had paperwork, because I took her to the attorney's office and she had all her paperwork. But that didn't stop ICE from taking her and deporting her. And she lived with me for almost 2 years. And I know she was fine. We were willing to sponsor her. I'm always willing to sponsor whoever needs sponsoring. And yet, again, that doesn't stop ICE from taking them. And to go and visit her at a detention center, because I wanted to make sure that she knew that I still cared for her and that I wished her luck, and that I loved her. And that was heartbreaking. It was extremely heartbreaking. And I don't know if people understand that when you're losing someone who you're very close to, you then have to say, well, I'm not allowing this to happen again to someone else. I have to do something. And as an organizer, because I was an organizer for the UAW, I said, I don't have to sit on the sidelines and take this. I know how to organize. I have done it. And I'm going to organize someone to help people who have their paperwork. how can you take someone who has paperwork that is, you know, all of a sudden what they thought was safe and that something they spent thousands of dollars on getting is vanished overnight, and now you're considered a criminal? I just don't understand that. And that's just not my view. I mean, that's a law. Everyone I speak to says that. So it's like, where's the judicial warrant to take them? What's the crime they've committed? You know, can you tell us the crime they committed as to why they're being deported? And many say, well, they entered without papers. No, they have papers. You know, it, even if you go according to ICE detention centers and you ask them for the A number, that alone took papers to get, right? Your A number, everyone has it. And to me, it's like, well, if they have an A number, they obviously didn't enter without seeking paperwork. So they did. So again, why are they being deported?
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Elida Reyes and Alexis Haik, who have been organizing with Community Aid for Empowerment, or CAFE, in Pontiac. Alexis, can you tell us a little bit about some of the work that CAFE has been trying to do to help folks?
We have created all of the different sections of our group based around what the community's needs are. So the first thing that came about, a more kind of obvious at the time approach, being if someone sees ICE on the streets, they can call us, we can record, we can, you know, get connected with their families, that sort of a thing. And then the follow-up of if they are transferred to a detention center, we can put money on their commissary and their calls so that they can get a little bit better treatment. They can contact their loved ones. We have other sections for advocacy, talking with local government, trying to get things changed, at least on a smaller scale. Obviously, there were big changes that we would love to make, but looking at what's realistic for Pontiac right now, we have a mutual aid that's dedicated to providing families with food, especially because most of the time their primary breadwinner has been taken and they don't have a means of work or providing for their families. We have sections for things like a business outreach or a Know Your Rights, making sure that businesses as well as individuals know what their rights actually are. Just as people, you don't have to have, you don't have to be a U.S. citizen just to have the basic rights as defined in the Constitution. So making sure that people are aware of those things, and then how to protect themselves from just the everyday injustices. And some things are as simple as, hey, make sure you're recording interactions, things like that, that could be helping their cases later.
I wonder if either of you has actually witnessed a detention in process. Elida, I don't know if your friend Vera, you know, if this happened in front of you, or if there was anything either of you could tell us about what those experiences are like.
My very first time, I can tell you the very first time I saw one, it was, got a call in the morning that a parent was being taken and it was close to the school and all the students could see it. And it was so early, and I was really, this is what got me going, is that I went with my pajamas on, my hair was all a mess, but I showed up because I was going to videotape it. And I got very upset when I watched them, of course, handcuff the father and put him in a car. But then I watched them pat down the mother, the wife, by one ICE agent, and then pat down again by a second one, and then a third one. And that's when I said, okay, they're just doing this in front of the husband on purpose. And I don't yell, but I did yell at them and I was very upset. And one of the ICE agents told me, what are you videotaping? And I said, I'm videotaping and this is going out on Facebook, because he told me he was going to arrest me. And I said, you're going to arrest a 70-year-old grandma who is videotaping you, watching you do this. You know, how is that going to fly? Because you're on Facebook. And then he said, well, just stand away from me. And I said, well, I'm 10 feet from you. And he said, that's right. Remember to stay that way. And I was just very upset. How could you? And it got me. It was not only were they doing this and I could see it, you turned around and looked and you could see the school and the kids watching. And I just thought, no wonder they're afraid.
I think the biggest thing that, not that I like witnessing this by any means, but I've seen dozens of people being detained at this point. And the biggest thing is always like seeing the people kind of take a breath when they realize that someone's here on my side. Someone's here witnessing what's happening. Someone's recording this. Someone will be able to tell my family that this has happened. Kind of just so that and that's honestly our biggest thing, is making sure that people know that they're not alone in this, that not everybody agrees with what's happening. I think that ICE is such a big system, and it's so easy to get into the Facebook comments, if you will, of just these horrible things about immigrants. And it's on a local level, on a personal level, being able to show people that this isn't right, this won't last forever, and we're here with you. It's also helped quite a few times with the recording alone. One of the ones that stands out to me is I had seen these 16-year-olds get pulled over, and on the recording, I have the ICE agent say, oh, well, the driver is a permanent resident. Like, okay, well, that will help the case later. Like, they know that they're not supposed to be doing these things, but the way that they are taking people, it's just, it's opportunistic. They see brown people driving, they pull them over and they take them. It's not what they would like you to believe of the worst of the worst. They're not catching criminals. They're taking regular everyday people. They find the loopholes and they take them. And a lot of times, you know, never to be seen again. So any time where we can get connected, where we can show the people that that's what we're here for, just that's really, to me, that's what it's all about.
Elida, families must go through a lot of problems just trying to know where someone who's detained is going to end up. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about how you help them figure that out?
I think that's better to be done by Alexis.
Oh, okay.
I usually deal with the families and the mothers and the sisters, and I make sure that they get the help that they need as far as attorneys, getting them to court, getting them to do that. Alexis is fantastic at finding someone, and then we relay it to the family. Alexis, do you want to share on how you do that?
Yeah, so there are a couple ways that we can do that. Technically, there is an ICE locator where if you know either the person's full name and country of origin or their A number and country of origin, you can find them that way. But I've noticed that that doesn't update as quickly as the commissary systems do, because of course, with it being all about money, that is always the first thing that gets updated. So I've gotten very good at finding people primarily because I will go through the commissary websites and start looking that way.
Another question I have for you, Elida, is what would you want the broader public to know, Elida, about what is happening in Pontiac right now?
To put it mildly, we're under attack. If you're brown and you live here, you have to be very careful of where you go and who you're with. And I just tell everyone, please, please be careful. And this will not last. For all those ICE agents who are doing this, this will not last. You know, I hope you understand that. You know, you are putting this out there that this is the type of person you are, and this will not last. And to the Latinos, esto no va a ser siempre. Esto va a pagar. Y nosotros vamos a estar aquí para ayudarte. You know, this will not last, and we're here to help you. We will help you to start over again.
There's no question that families who are immigrants, or some of whom are immigrants, are the ones experiencing the most effects right now. Alexis, I am curious if you've seen some wider effects for the community more broadly.
I think it boils down to that participation aspect of events that would have normally have been full or had a lot of community participation are now rarely attended, or they don't have any engagement like there used to be. I've noticed that on my walks, it used to be all sorts of, you know, loud music playing and just people enjoying the sunshine. And now I'm kind of the only one walking around. So seeing things like that, it's very hard to see what was once a very vibrant community. Just now, everyone's locked in their houses, especially on beautiful days like today. It's just really hard to think about.
Elida, what is it that you most want people to understand about the work that you do?
If you feel that what is going on is wrong, we take funding. We really do. I know she laughs but I'm always asking, please help me to help other people, because none of this is free. We pay for food. We pay for gas travel. We pay for things that people overlook. We have a gentleman who was released from Northlake who has a parasite or a bacteria. The reason he was released is one of them. He also had to pay a bond, but he was going blind. And so we're trying to help him with that. I know it sounds like I'm begging, but actually, I guess I am. If any way that you can help us with these things, you know, please do.
My guests today have been Alexis Hike and Elida Reyes, who are part of the group CAFE, or Community Aid for Empowerment, in Pontiac. Elida, Alexis, thank you both very much for speaking to us about your work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
We also want to say thanks to Dustin Blitchock of Planet Detroit for his reporting on Pontiac. We're going to take a quick break. After that, using a vintage format to re-examine the state around us.
I discovered the Federal Writers Project state guides, and I bought a Michigan one published in 1941, and I actually started using it, and it still held up.
Explore mid-Michigan with us when we get back. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The things that we know about our homes in Michigan can and do fill entire books. But for a lot of different reasons, our written record doesn't always make it into all the parts of Michigan that we experience. A couple of editors recently worked with regional writers to revive an old and beloved tradition in 20th century history, and the resulting book lavishes love on some places you might describe to out-of-state friends along the knuckles of your extended palm, from the iconic towns to the untold natural spaces and all the folks who live here. The book is called Exploring Mid-Michigan, A Guide to Flint, Saginaw Valley, and the Thumb. Joining me now is Mary Jo Keatsman. She's a professor of English at the University of Michigan Flint and a co-editor of this book. Mary Jo, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're also speaking with one of the contributors, Bob Campbell. His byline has graced the Flint Journal and the Detroit Free Press. You may have seen his work shared through Belt Publishing, and he's the author of the novel Motown Man. Bob Campbell, welcome. It's good to have you as well.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Mary Jo, the concept for this book is amazing. It's not exactly a travelogue, as the title may suggest to us. Can you explain the genesis of the project in your mind?
The genesis began with me walking the length of the St. Clair River from the Blue Water Bridge in Port Huron down to the end of Harsons Island. I was planning a class where students in their freshman year would be exploring local rivers. And about that time, it was during COVID, I discovered the Federal Writers Project state guides. And I bought a Michigan one published in 1941, and I actually started using it, and it still held up. It still, you know, it told me that there was a railroad tunnel that went under the St. Clair River.
So this is the WPA, the same project that gave us great art and architecture within the national parks and in public buildings.
Exactly.
The federal government was employing writers in this way.
Right. The Federal Writers Project was the writers branch of the WPA. So writers were paid to collect information about sites, people, their work, their culture, and they produced these guides. And essentially, they were showing America to Americans during a time of crisis, because, of course, it was the Great Depression. So we wanted to do the same thing, create a self-portrait of our region from the ground up for the people that lived here and to interest visitors in taking a look, taking a trip, exploring it as well.
Yeah. The tone is so special in that I think it speaks to people with both those possibilities in mind. There's a little passage in the preface that talks about what the idea was here for what the content should involve. Do you mind reading a little bit for us?
Sure. Flint's tainted water supply was still on everyone's minds at the start of the project, but a focus on rivers and the greater watershed promised to take us somewhere new, beyond our troubled city's limits. Local history, by its nature, whether written by antiquarians, genealogists, or academics, tends to be just that, local. It focuses on a particular place defined by political boundaries, city, village, township, county, and ignores the places that surround it. People who live in one place likely know little about places outside their own stomping grounds. This lack of familiarity extends to people with differing political views. White and Black people often fear each other's environments. City people think rural areas are just playgrounds. Country folks view cities as dangerous. If we harbor any hope to advance our country, then we need to get beyond our little comfort zones and explore outside them. We traveled the region for 4 years and were surprised by how much more connected things were in the past, before the automobile, redlining, the highway system, deindustrialization, and new technologies split places and people apart. Hope grew that our work might suggest ways to mend some of these broken links, or at the very least, make local people more curious about places they don't know or avoid.
That's so lovely. Bob Campbell, the piece that you wrote for this collection has to do with Shea Lake. And some folks, they know, may know exactly what we're talking about, and it'll bring up a lot of memories, but others may be completely unaware of it. Can you explain Shea Lake and what it was in your life as a young person?
Yes. So Shea Lake is about, 30 miles north of Lapeer in southeastern Tuscola County, straight up M-24. And about 45 acres is about the size of the lake. So not a very big lake, but particularly during my childhood and teen years, even into early adulthood, it was a very magical place from a recreational standpoint. And I talk about the go-go 70s is when it was really popping at that time. Boating, kids riding motorcycles, just kind of hanging out. And it really was a special place. And my parents, they were among the first to build a cottage up there as sort of these, the Black working class, middle class that began there. And this was in the late 50s. Much of the lake was undeveloped at that time. And it just sort of took off from there. And it took off as Idlewild. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with Idlewild over in the west side of the state, as that was sort of as its heyday was sort of on the wane, Shea Lake was on the rise, and it was really a great place to spend summers.
Yeah. You shared the story in the book of Clarence Campbell and his wife, Rose, who were the initial family that made the space possible. It's obviously gone through some changes over the years. There was a remembrance in your part of this book where Daryl Buchanan is talking about just what it was like and what it meant in terms of his childhood. Would you mind reading a little bit from what he had to say about that?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I think what Daryl had to say really captured the era very well. Daryl Buchanan called Shea Lake the setting for his, quote, coming of age, unquote, story. It was a carefree time. For me, it was like the Wonder Years, said Buchanan, referring to the popular ABC series that was reprised in 2021. With a Black family in the title role. A magical place for me, he said, and everybody had a motorcycle, although he did not have one himself. His only worry at the lake were the drop-offs, a transition area where the lake's shallow bottom suddenly drops into deeper water. A Detroit native, Buchanan grew up near the epicenter of the 67 riot and witnessed it unfold. But his father and stepmother owned a waterfront cottage from 67 to 75, located on the Point, a soft peninsula on the lake's west side. Shea Lake Heights, the so-called New Side, it provided an escape from the city and the neighborhood, he said. And I can remember standing in the front room and seeing the lake on three sides. It was pretty awesome. He also remembers meeting the most beautiful girl I can ever remember seeing at Shea Lake. She was visiting a neighbor that had a cottage at the lake. Once at the lake, Buchanan said, I hung out with Jesse Stevens and his crew. Jesse was Mr. Shea Lake to me. I mean, he was just the man. Stevens, whose parents owned and operated Shea Lake Grocery, a small grocery store and gas station, was also well known for his water skiing exploits. Mr. Shea Lake, who hailed from Highland Park, often joined with Derek Williamson, another outstanding water skier, in showing off their dazzling slalom work on the lake.
Bob, the thing I absolutely love about that passage is not just that it gives us a sense of what was going on there, but it just captures that pantheon of folks at the lake as a lot of people experience them in a lot of different cultures, while being very specific to the Black families that found much needed respite there. I know this that you've written about Shea Lake more than once, but was doing it for this collection in this form, was there anything you were able to get into in a little different way?
Oh, yes. One, just the history of the lake itself, its long history, and sort of the different transitions it had gone through. The other thing, too, is in writing the story, as I was doing some of the property records research, it occurred to me, I was like, I think a lot of these properties were bought on land contract. I didn't know that for sure. And I didn't spend a lot of time trying to verify that, but just kind of looking at some of the transactions. Well, after this piece was done, the son of Arden Thompson, who was one of the key developers of the lake, reached out to me. He's actually mentioned in my piece, Philip Thompson is his name. Well, he had heard about an earlier piece that I had written and reached out to me. I wrote about him in my piece that my older brother and him played together when they were kids. So, and he remembered my brother. But the thing that he was able to verify for me is that I asked him about the land contract. I was like, my sense is that a lot of these properties were bought on land contract. He's like, yes. He's like, in fact, my mother processed all those transactions, did all the record keeping for those land contracts to purchase those cottages. So that was a really interesting follow-up.
If you're just joining us, that's my guest, Bob Campbell, and Mary Jo Keatsman. Bob is a contributor and Mary Jo one of the editors of Exploring Mid-Michigan, a guide to Flint, Saginaw Valley, and the Thumb. Bob Campbell, in the course of your research for this, can you maybe tell us about what it's like at Shea Lake these days?
Yes. You know, my parents sold their property in the early 2000s, and there have been a lot of property transfers there, you know, not surprisingly, some properties that have been abandoned. And so, you know, the composition of the lake has gone from being a largely cottage resort summer place to more year-round residence. In fact, the people who bought my parents' property live there year-round. The other thing that I would point out is that whereas the resort aspect of the lake was overwhelmingly, if not all Black residents. Today, the racial composition has changed. I believe the home or the Lake Association president mentioned that maybe it's like 70-30 white or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And so it has much more of a almost the feel of a gated community.
There's a question I'd like to ask both of you. You know, you had different roles to play in this book coming together, of course. There are reasons why Detroit and the UP I guess, manifest themselves a little bit differently in literary form, as, you know, the Paris of the Midwest in Detroit's case, as an engine of the economy that Mission became in terms of the UP. But Mid-Michigan sometimes, you know, I think gets a little bit of short shrift. And I guess I want to ask both of you what you wish more people understood about the diverse communities that are represented in the book.
Yeah. Well, speaking specifically about the piece that I wrote, you know, there were a lot of people from Detroit that had cottages there, as well as some from Saginaw and from Flint. But the idea or the reality that there was this place called Shea Lake on this side of the state that so popular and provided such opportunity for unusual, you know, or different types of recreational activities, I think is something that I'm really proud to be able to share with, you know, a wider audience. Because in some ways it was, you know, to use the cliche, you know, one of Michigan's best kept secrets. But I think it's also one of the best kept secrets among Michigan's Black residents, because except for, you know, a quote unquote privileged few who had the opportunity to have a place like up there. But the other thing that was really interesting about it too, and I didn't really appreciate this until I got older, is that it didn't seem unusual to us. And I remember taking friends up there and you know, they had no real concept of it. They were coming up, man, wow, this, I had no idea. My sister's husband essentially said the same thing. So that kind of that best kept secret aspect of it is something I'm proud to be able to share.
Mary Jo, what would you say? I mean, we have everything here from, you know, cities like Saginaw and Flint to places in the Thumb that, again, are very, very rural and more of a pastoral setting. What do you wish was better understood?
I think what I wish was better understood is that our region really drew people here, starting with, I mean, people from different ethnic groups, from different countries, from different states in our own country, because it started with lumber. Sugar beets are really an underrated crop. They were so important, and we began farming them here in 1903. I have to tell you, I tried cooking with sugar beets. Don't do it.
It is not for the faint of heart. I mean, that is some processing time right there.
Right. I mean, and they drew checks first from Nebraska, and then Russian Germans from the Volga region of Russia, and then Mexicans. So, you know, that's why we have, like, you can go to a Czech festival just across the Shiawassee County line, which I did with my husband last weekend. There are Mexican communities here, and there's still that pipeline. But, you know, there are people here, obviously the Great Migration brought Black folks up from, you know, Arkansas and Mississippi. I think they are in Georgia. And another thing that people do not know too much about is the Hillbilly Highway, where, you know, poor white Southerners came up and worked in these cities. And in Flint, we have a hillbilly ghetto called Little Missouri. And that has never been studied or written about until the essay in this book.
Mary Jo Keatsman is the editor of Exploring Mid-Michigan, A Guide to Flint, Saginaw Valley, and the Thumb. We've also been speaking with writer Bob Campbell, who contributed to this anthology.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, April.
And that's all for Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Ronia Cabansag, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Nicholas Alumkal, Isabella Jacob, and Yenna Vasise. We have to say goodbye to Nicholas today, but it is with a mix of feelings. He has been great fun and a great worker to have on the team. Take care, Nicholas, and good luck with all the great things in front of you. Stateside is a production of Michigan Public. You can find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.